You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Oh, hello. I didn't see you there. Welcome to Digging Up Ancient Aliens. This is the podcast where we examine strange claims about alternative history and ancient aliens in popular media. Do the claims hold water to an archaeologist, or are there better explanations out there? We are now on episode 59. I am your host, Frederick. Since we are so close to Easter, maybe it's time to discuss something connected to this holiday. So why not talk about the Shroud of Turin? Some claim the cloth carries an image of Jesus Christ himself. Others have pointed out that making a copy of it is relatively simple. And yes, ancient aliens are using the shroud as evidence for their alien hypothesis. Our exploration of the shroud will be divided into two parts, trying to make things as easy as we can to follow. Today, we will deal with the cloth historical events, from its shrouded origin to initial accusation of being a hoax and its journey to Turin. And next time, we will look more at the studies and tests performed in more recent modern times, such as the famous photos and the C-14 test by Sturp in 1988. I've also done something a little bit unusual for the show. I have translated a few documents from Latin to English. While I quote some bits here and there, you can find the full versions of these texts on the website. On that note, I want to thank all of you who support the show through Patreon or the members portal. Your contribution helps to make the show better and provide good information to the public. If you want to help, stay to the end and I will tell you exactly how you can do this. And remember that you find sources, resources, reading suggestions on our website, diggingupancientaliens.com. There you can also find the contact info to me if you notice any mistakes or have any suggestions. And if you like the podcast, I really appreciate if you left one of those fancy star reviews that I heard so much about, or tell a friend. Now that we have finished our preparation, let's dig into the episode. So where do we begin a story and examination of something like the Shroud of Turin? An excellent place to start, I guess, is to describe it. As usual, we will begin looking at this through the eyes of the ancient alien promoters. And I want you to pay a little bit of attention on how the ancient aliens promoters are presenting the Shroud throughout the episode and the next episode.
The Shroud of Turin is a piece of ancient linen cloth, measures about 14 feet long by 3.5 feet wide. And what's so important about this cloth is there's a very faint imprint of a human being on the cloth who appears to have been crucified, which matches the biblical descriptions of Jesus Christ. So many believe that this shroud, this relic, is the actual burial cloth of Jesus Christ and bears the wounds of crucifixion.
So that's the basic information about the Turin Shroud, a piece of linen cloth 4.4 meters long and about 1 meter wide. Upon this cloth, yellow with age and riddled with holes, we can see a weak imprint of the front and back of what appears to be a man. His hand is laid so that it covers his private parts, and the soles of his feet have, well, left an imprint on the cloth. Yet somehow, the hollow of the knee is still visible on the cloth. So this is the basics regarding the Turin Shroud, and something everyone can agree upon. Most things other than this are not often as clear. How would a believer describe our understanding of the Turin Shroud then? Luckily, we have Father William Fulco who can help us answer this question.
The Shroud of Turin has such a fascinating history, and the question is it authentic? Those who are against it say, no, this could easily have been a fake, and a body would never have left such an image and so on. The chemicals of an embalmed body would not done such a thing. But the people who say that are not able to explain how the figure did get there. It's not painted. It doesn't seem to be a pigment that's applied to the cloth.
Proving the authenticity of the Shroud of Turin have been a goal of Sindonologists for a long time. In the 1950s, investigations of the Turin Shroud were looked at if there was its own discipline, and the term Sindonology were adopted for this perceived new field. It will become evident that while Sindonology sounds scientific, it's not really scientific. Like many pseudoscientific claims we look into in this podcast, for example, this discipline usually starts at its preferred result and try to work itself backward to find evidence that fits this preferred narrative. As we look into the allegations and history of the Turin Shroud, we will see that the Sindonologists do a little bit of, or quite a lot of, cherry-picking, moving goalposts, and several other logical fallacies. We will see how evidence is strangely ruled out, and the claim that nobody can explain how the image appear will be a mantra that will be, well, often repeated. We already have two quotes from the show, and yet we don't really know anything about the Turin Shroud's history or what's going on and what's been examined. So let's change this. Let's shift into the history and the beginning of the Shroud of Turin. You might wonder why I and the literature always use the term Turin Shroud, or shortened to TS, or the Shroud of Turin. If this would be the burial shroud of Jesus, why not call it the Shroud or the Shroud of Jesus? Well, that's because, as with so many relics, there are several shrouds out there that are all claimed to be Jesus' burial shroud. The Turin Shroud just happened to be the most known to the public. As with many relics, the churches are cluttered with these items, like the pile of clothes on a teenager's bed. Theologian John Calvin opined over the amount of true crosses in existence back in 1543. He wrote, quote, "In short, if we were to collect all these pieces of the true cross exhibited in various parts, they would form a whole ship's cargo." So John Calvin was not really a fan of those out to deceive people with these relics. He portrays them quite harshly, like a snail oil salesman. His words were not kinder when he, in treatises on relics, talk about the numerous shrouds in existence. Quote, "For whoever admitted the reality of one of these sudaris shown in so many places must have considered the rest as wicked impostors set up to deceive the public by the presence that they were each the real sheet in which Christ's body had been wrapped." So there seem to be several shrouds in existence in 1543, and Calvin was not buying it. He continued by writing, "But it's not only that the exhibitors of these one and the same relic give each other mutually the lie. They are, what is far more important, positively contradicted by the gospel." So, how many shrouds have there been in the world? It's not an easy question to answer, but in Relics of the Christ, Jo Nichols cites Thomas Humber and get the number to 42 known shrouds in medieval Europe. We have, for example, the Shroud of Compiègne, which was widely visited and celebrated. It was, however, lost during the French Revolution, when taste of ash, dust, and freedom fill the air. Another example would be the Holy Shroud of Cadouin, brought to France by the Crusaders in 1098 CE. Surviving wars and revolution, it was worshipped until 1935, when Nichols and Humber points out the ornamental bands on the Holy Shroud were realized to consist of Kufic writings with Muslim blessings. The message of this writing within the textile shown that the textile had been created for the vizier of the Caliph of Cairo, who fought during the First Crusade. We also have accounts of a holy shroud of Constantinople, supposed later split into several pieces and sent across the continent. Another famous example is the holy shroud of Besançon. Unfortunately, it met the same fate as the Shroud of Compiègne and was swallowed by the flames of the revolution. An intriguing thing regarding the Besançon shroud is, while the fabric is no longer with us, we have actually depictions of it. A 17th century engraving shows the shroud, and this depiction looks eerily similar to the Turin shroud. When sinologists discuss the Turin shroud, they rarely mention that there are several competing shrouds. The Turin shroud seems to have taken the lead due to its great publicity, as we will see later on. For now, though, I think we should shift our attention to the shroud's history. A history that's, again, often left out of the narrative by believers. The story in front of us doesn't start in the small town of Turin in Italy, but actually in France. To be precise, a small village named Lyrie, a skip and a stone southeast of Paris. While we know where it starts, the when is a bit shrouded in mystery. As Nickel points out, there are accounts mentioning 1353 as the year the shroud should have entered the scene. According to this version, Geoffrey de Carnay, a knight of honor and chivalry, present the shroud to the dean of the Lyrie Abbey. De Charnay then build the Church of Our Lady of Charnay to store this relic. The issue regarding this claim is, while the church was built, an inventory was taken during 1357, and that inventory don't mention the shroud. To be fair, De Charnay could have kept the fabric at home for some reason during this period. What we know for sure is that the Shroud of Turin went up on display in 1357, later that year, and it was advertised as the real burial cloth of Jesus Christ. And the advertising, well, it worked, and soon pilgrims start to flock to Lyrie, pilgrims that brought money with them. Humans have not really changed that much. Our love for knickknacks and souvenirs seem to be an appetite that's have been with us for, well, centuries by now. Of course, the little wooden church of Our Lady was prepared for this and had little medallions struck. A small and most likely expensive token to remember the visit by. Two known Lyrie pilgrim badges are still in existence, and one was found in the Seine River in 1855 by a man named Fograis. The actual mold was found in 2009. Unfortunately, it was uncovered by a group of hobby metal detectorists operating against French regulations, something Ian Wilson discovered when researching the mold, and this object is unfortunately still in private possession. Looking at the badge, however, we see that the print seems, a little bit more visible of the Jesus figure, or the man figure. It's not the faint picture we see today. Again, it resembles the Besançon shroud in how it's depicted on this badge. And after the break, we will talk about the medieval forger that might be behind the Shroud of Turin. Fellow archaeology lovers, science nerd, and history enthusiast, have you ever dreamt of showcasing your passion for our history and science? Dig no further. Welcome to the official merchandise store for your favorite podcast, Digging Up Ancient Aliens. Embark on a journey through time with our exclusive collection. Wrap yourself in the mysteries of the past with our range of themed shirts, mugs, and apparel. Each piece tells a story about your passions and podcast preference. And for the devoted archaeology aficionados, unveil our latest treasure, the Archaeology Mafia T-shirt. It is more than just apparel. It's a statement, a tribute to those who dig deeper, question the unknown, and unravel the secrets of our ancestors. These are not just merchandise. They are future relics from a time yet to be fully understood. Symbols of your dedication to unveiling the truth behind ancient aliens and the real wonders of our past. Join the crew of Digging Up Ancient Aliens, wear your curiosity, flaunt your knowledge, and join the Archaeology Mafia. Visit our store now and you will get an offer you can't refuse. Let's keep the spirit of exploration alive. Log on to diggingupancientaliens.com/store and grab your piece of history. Remember, the past is always present. The money and claims about the relic would soon gain the church attention. 1389, Bishop Pereira de Arcis launched the first investigation into the Turin Shroud. In a letter to the first antipope of Avignon, Clement VII, the Arcis wrote about his suspicion and the evidence he had accumulated. The case, Holy Father, stands thus. Some time since in this diocese of Troyes, the dean of a certain collegiate church, to wit, that of Lyri, falsely and deceitfully, being consumed with the passion of avarice, and not from any motive of devotion but only of gain, produced for his church a certain cloth cunningly painted, upon which a clever sleight of hand was depicted the twofold image of one man, that is to say, the back and the front, he falsely declaring and pretending that this was the actual shroud in which our Savior, Jesus Christ, was enfold in the tomb. This story was put about not only in the Kingdom of France, but, so to speak, throughout the world, so that from all parts people could come together to view it, and further to attract the multitude so that money might cunningly be wrung from them. Pretense miracles were worked, certain men being hired to represent themselves as healed at the moment of exhibition of the shroud, which all believed to be the shroud of our Lord. Pierre de Arcis is quite straightforward and don't really spare the words here. The shroud was a forgery. In this memorandum preserved for us, Darcis continued to state what his investigation had revealed, that the burial cloth were made by human hands. Eventually, after diligent inquiry and examination, he discovered that fraud and how the said cloth had been cunningly painted, the truth being attested by the artist who painted it, to wit, that it was the work of human skill and not miraculously wrought or bestowed. So that's some pretty damning accusations. The bishop confidently asserts that the Carnet lied about and forged the burial cloth from the beginning. So what did come out of all of this? Well, nothing. This does not mean that he didn't try. Darcis certainly tried, as we will see, but he was a little bit unlucky, to say the least. In late July 1389, the bishop contacted Pope Clement VII. From what we can tell, he quickly felt sidelined and tried to bypass the ecclesiastic route by going straight to King Charles VI. And the king took the bishop's suspicions very seriously. He even sent out his bailiffs to seize the cloth presented as the burial vestments for Jesus. And the knights did an honest try, but they were not allowed into the treasury by the dean of the church. They put a seal on the door and went to dinner, and the next day, Dean Nicole Martin filed an official appeal, and the knight felt that that was a little bit too much of a hassle and kind of just let everything go. It's, however, worth mentioning that around this time, Geoffrey II de Charnay was part of the king's entourage for the coronation of Queen Isabel of Batavia. Having direct access to the king's ear might explain why the bailiff, well, gave up rather quickly trying to recover the shroud. In 1389, the head of the Charnay household was Geoffrey II, the son of the original alleged custodian of the Turin Shroud. Unknown to the bishop, Pope Clement VII and Geoffrey had close family ties. As Shroud proponent Ian Wilson puts it,
before Clement became Pope, he had been known as Robert of Geneva. His father was the cousin of Aimon of Geneva, Geoffrey de Charnay II's stepfather, who had died the year before. Geoffrey II de Charnay was thereby family for Clement. And although we cannot be certain that he and Geoffrey were actually together at the time Bishop d'Arcy's letter arrived in Avignon, the family tie certainly goes some way to explain what happened next.
On January 5th, 1390 CE, Clement VII sent a letter and a papal bull, And instead of approving to investigate the matter further, the bishop diocese was ordered to leave the matter and remain silent under the threat of excommunication. And the letters have been preserved. We have two of them. One is stored in the National Library in Paris, and one can be found in the Vatican archives. While the bishops is ordered to let this go, the Pope seemed to somewhat believe, to some extent, Darcy's claims. In the letter, we can read that the Church, quote, shall not perform any solemnities that are accustomed to be performed in showing relics, and that therefore no torches, light, or candles should be lit for any solemnity, nor any lights whatsoever be used there for that purpose, and that the one showing the said figure when a larger crowd of people has gathered there should at least sometimes, while a sermon is given, publicly proclaim to the people in a loud, intelligent voice, with all deceit ceasing, that they do not show said figure or representation as the true shroud of our Lord Jesus Christ, but as a figure or representation of said shroud, which is said to be the same our Lord Jesus Christ. The same is repeated in a second letter sent that day, but with the added phrase in it, quote,
but rather a certain painting or picture made in the form of or representation of the shroud, which is said to be the same our Lord Jesus Christ.
In the Vatican copy, however, the words painting or picture were crossed out on May 30, the same year, by John of Napoli, most likely to make the copy stored in the archive more like the letter sent out the same day, as labeled in Chevalier, the letter J or parenthesis K lacks the reference to this being a painting, while the letter referred to as K or N in parentheses has. This change is not reflected in the copy stored in the National Library in Paris. Some sinologists claim that this change showed that this shroud must be the real burial cloth of Jesus, somehow ignoring that the Pope stated it's not the shroud of Jesus, but a representation, whether it's a painting or not. Maybe the change was implemented to keep a, well, single narrative, trying to avoid accidentally give Darcy's right in that the shroud was just a painting and that it would somehow been able to be used against them later. Or they wanted to ensure that there was enough ambiguity about the shroud when the church containing the Torii shroud was given the right to sell indulgences later in June. This later part is some speculation on my side. We know that there are some differences in the letter and that for some reason they struck out three words a few months later. A reasonably easy question that Darcy's asked from the start but never get an answer to is how the Carnet got the cloth from the start. Looking at the letters and the accounts we have, this has never been answered by, well, anyone. Something that would have been pretty easy to do if Geoffrey de Charnay the Elder got the shroud during the Crusades, for example. One might then ask why the shroud was not used as, for example, Peter Bartholomew's Holy Lance in Antioch. Maybe the Charnay wanted to keep it to himself for later, but would not this be able to, you know, prove the shroud's authenticity? He got it in the Holy Lance and he got it from a place that most likely would fit with Jesus' burial? Or was it acquired through trade? In that case, who, where, when? I mean, it's not hard questions to even make up an answer to, but still, it just appear one day in 1350 and nobody bothers to find out from where or why. I do have to give Darcy's that he was tenacious. He really did his best to prove his case that the Shroud of Turin was a fake and a forgery. If it not had been that the Pope was related to the Carnet and that the King just happened to invite the Carnet as part of his entourage just then, who knows what the investigation would have turned up. Maybe we even would have known the name of the artist who created the Shroud. Unfortunately, if history tells us something, you can get away with basically anything if you have the right connections. After the break, we will get out of Lyra and into the fire. A burning question that we might not have answered yet is how on earth the Turin Shroud ended up in Italy. Well, this was done with the help of Geoffrey II de Charnay's daughter, Margaret de Charnay, with her husband, Humbert de Villers-Sexel, took the shroud from the abbey for safekeeping, as they put it. Humbert even promised it would be returned to the church when the hostilities from the Hundred Years' War, which lasted 116 years, were over. Margaret, however, never gave it back and instead sold it to Louis I of Savoy. While some claim this was a gift, Margaret actually got a sum of 2 castles for it, as Nichols points out. This stunt did not impress the church where the Turin Shroud was initially housed. Having the relic removed from the church had affected their income from pilgrims and the sale of indulgence quite a lot. The canon, a title for one part of the ecclesiastic rule, demanded the Turin Shroud to be returned to them, or Margaret would face excommunication. After several warnings, an official excommunication was issued on May 30, 1457. And Margaret then answered that a compensation of 800 gold ducats would be issued to the Church of Lyra as a compensation for the loss. And trying to convert ducats to modern value is a little bit tricky, since it's hard to factor in the spending power of the time into the equation. I'll put it like this. Towards the end of his life, Leonardo da Vinci was paid 400 ducats a year by the French king. And to Leonard, 1 ducat would have been basically pocket money, but it would have been a 10-day pay for one of his apprentices. But the month came and they went, but no gold, silver, or even a piece of copper was sent to the church on Lyra. So on January 19th of 1458, Margaret was called in front of the provost, and this is a rank similar to that of bishop, and it was located in Troyes. She did not show up, however, for this hearing, but she was defended by her half-brother, Charles de Noyers, and Charles promised that 800 ducats would be paid, with an additional 300 ducats for the church legal fees. For this, the church pledged to lift the excommunication temporarily, and if the fine was paid by October 1458, it would be suspended completely. Now, October came and went, but no money was sent to the church. Margaret would later die in 1460 without paying a single ducat to the church. The canons in Lyra had not given up, however, and now went after the House of Savoy instead. They did not have much luck retrieving the cloth bag, but Duke Louis offered a small yearly token amount to be paid to the church in Lyra, a sum that was paid until Louis' death. His descendants would not continue to pay this token amount. At this point, the clergy went to the King of France. Unfortunately, we do not know the outcome of this complaint. We can tell that the shroud was left in Savoy Chapel and that the wooden church in Lyra would go into, well, a state of harsh disrepair and would soon be abandoned after this. Some who want to give Margaret a good reason for keeping the cloth try to argue that she did not give the cloth back due to the state of the church in Lyra. However, this argument don't really work from a historical perspective, since the church did not deteriorate until, well, their source of money dried up when the shroud was removed. So the Shroud of Turin was kept in Savoy's possession in the Savoy Chapel, but since it's not known as the Shroud of Savoy, there is still a small part left of this story. In 1471, Amadeus IX of Savoy petitioned Pope Sixtus IV to be able to build a sanctuary for the Shroud. The wish was granted, and in 1502 it was finished. In 1506, after petitioning the Pope Julius II, the church was named Sainte-Chapelle of the Holy Shroud. With this, a special feast was instituted for the Shroud. With this new honor, droves of pilgrims start to arrive at the chapel. And everything was, well and good until 1532. On December 4th, a fire would spread throughout the chapel. Two Franciscan monks were able to save the Shroud by the skin of their teeth. And with a feat like that, one would think someone would have bothered to name these monks, but no. Unfortunately, molten silver has dripped on the edges of the folded shroud, making large holes that you most likely are familiar with today. In 1535, the shroud would go on to be on a tour and be displayed at a handful of places in both Italy and in France. Turin would be the final resting spot due to political act to move the Savoy capital. Except for a brief period during World War II, the shroud would not leave Turin again. At this point, it was rumored to have extraordinary powers, and the proclaims of Clement VII were long forgotten. And that is the known history of the cloth, from its beginning to it becoming the Shroud of Turin. So, to wrap it up, we've traversed a landscape dot with twists and turns, but from the start it seems to have been questions regarding the authenticity of the Shroud of Turin. It's intriguing to ponder the what if. What if Pope Clement had green-lighted an exhaustive investigation? What if the artist, assuming there was one, had been given credit for what could arguably be the greatest art hoax of the millennium? But from the information we have so far, the evidence lean toward a fabrication, I would say. The sudden appearance and the focus on money for most of its history is usually a telltale sign that something is wrong and it could possibly be a hoax. Not necessarily with the intent from the Charnay. There could be bought by someone and he was fooled. He could be the victim of a fraud himself. Yet, if they purchased it, why not disclose it when these questions were asked later? Why was the origin kept secret from the get-go? Again, there are many, many what-if, but how is it with this hard scientific evidence? Some say, yes, there are a lot of that, and others say, no, there's not really any evidence. So in the next episode, we will go through the scientific evidence claimed to exist surrounding the Shroud of Turin. Until next time, please spread the word by leaving a positive review on platforms like iTunes, Spotify, or even better, recommend the episode to your friends. Over at diggingupancientanus.com, you can find an extensive list of sources and resources used to create this episode. You can use them to expand your knowledge on the Turin Shroud. And if you want to support the show, head over to patreon.com/diggingupancientaliens, or if you prefer, you can sign up at our member portal instead over at diggingupancientaliens.com/support. Both routes give you ad-free episode, often a little bit earlier, with additional bonus episode. Or you can instead support the APN network by becoming a member over there. Just head over to archaeologicalpodcastnetwork.com. If you want to contact me, it can be done through most social media sites or by sending an email to frederick@diggingupancientaliens.com. Sandra Martelor created the intro music, and our outro is by the band called Trallskruv, who sings their song Foliehatt. Links to both of these artists can be found in the show notes. Until next time, keep shoveling that science. Men jag skyddar mig, för jag har foliehatt. Och så säger ni, så säger det är en galen fantasi, att jag ens manipulerar oss med telepati. Ni tycker att jag redan är besatt, men jag skyddar mig, för jag har foliehatt. Thank you for tuning in and listening to this episode. Remember that we have a subscription going on. You can become a patron or other subscriber for as little as $2.50 per episode. Go to diggingupancientaliens.com/support. That is, go to diggingupancientaliens.com/support to read more information and sign up right there.